America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krawczyk. And John, good and bad. Now, this isn't something that you and I often address on this podcast, because how can we be that judgmental? We're just flawed individuals ourselves. But when you look at the overarching concern that we've got in our society that we can't trust, people, we can't trust institutions. We're being let down left, right, and center, whether it's banks like Wells Fargo offering these credit cards that nobody asked for, whether it's in the workplace where we've got Me Too allegations that are going on every day. We have parents trying to buy a place for their kids into college. We've got pharmaceutical companies refusing to acknowledge their responsibility. So what do we do about it, John?
Boy, you know, if I had that answer, I'd be rich, I think, because, you know, the world is so upside down right now. And then you got social media putting out information that's, you know, I mean, you got good information, but then you got bad information that's there forever. I'm not sure how we solve this problem.
Well, maybe you're right. I mean, this has been going on since time immemorial. But I think what is different today in the culture is how quickly we spread that information, we share it, and we amplify it. I mean, look right now at Governor Cuomo and the issue that he's addressing, five women coming forward and accusing him of sexual improprieties or at least harassment. And, you know, you say to yourself, where does this begin, end? Is anybody really left out of this equation? How flawed are we all as individuals? And how much does the society in which we live and the examples that we set or the people we hold up as role models, are we making a mistake just doing that to begin with?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right, but what's even weirder about Cuomo is he got an award for the way he handled COVID, and he mishandled the nursing homes. I mean, it's just, it's incredible what's going on.
No, it really is, and it's really important, because unless we do reestablish that trust, I mean, so many of us are putting so much of our lives and information online. We don't know whether we can trust anybody with that information. And I think even if you go back just several years, John, when the Catholic Church, when we found out what had been going on for so many years within the church, I mean, I was shocked. I mean, literally, that this could be as pervasive as it was. And sometimes I'm stunned to think that there are true believers left out there with the way that we mere mortals have let them down. So I just don't know how we head our way out of this to a more honorable place. But Grant McCracken, John, is with us. He is a cultural anthropologist, and he looks at these issues, and he has to scratch his head, I mean, clearly, to try to figure this out. But he's going to give us some pathways, perhaps, back to a more decent and honorable place for our society. But it's not going to be an easy road, John.
Well, I'm anxious to hear what he's got to say, because, I mean, I can't even begin to figure out how to get us back into a place where, you know, our honor and our morality gets back to something normal, something we can trust people, you know? I mean, it's unbelievable.
But do you think it's any worse than it was in previous generations, or again, that we just swept it under the rug in the past, or we didn't expose it on all these platforms, or is the behavior itself worse? I'm trying to figure that out.
Well, I don't know. I think people, I mean, we're so polarized now to begin with that you know, people aren't talking to people. I mean, you know, I think in the old days, too, we watched the same news programs, so we got the same information and we were able to talk about it. Now everybody's on each side of the court there, and then you got social media, which puts everybody. So I think the problem is we're so polarized, I think.
Yeah, perhaps people are trying to drive harder wedges into problems that exist, but may not have gotten the same amount of attention in the past. Well, I don't want to become inured to scandal and shame, because I do think that we need to uphold various standards. What they are, maybe we're going to have a hard time agreeing on that as the fractured society that you tell us we are, and I agree with you. Well, let's go to Grant McCracken and see what he has to say about this. I think you're going to find it quite interesting today on America Trends. With me on America Trends is Grant McCracken. And he's written a book called The New Honor Code, a simple plan for raising our standards and restoring our good names. And you are a cultural anthropologist who looks at issues like honor and studies people and cultures. What would you say about the American culture in 2021? Are we a particularly honorable society?
Oh, it's a difficult time, isn't it? We're tested to the limit of all limits, intellectual and social and cultural and moral. I guess going into COVID, we were in a period of some confusion, some turbulence, and you know, I kept picking up the newspaper and reading yet another story about yet another person charged with some public trust who'd found a way to abuse that trust pretty spectacularly. You know, Larry Nassar would be one case in point. People who were not just behaving badly, but behaving as if a good behavior had never occurred to them, or that bad behavior was not objectionable. They seemed to be just acting freely to do what they want, even when that was spectacularly abusive of the trust with which they've been charged.
But we have read throughout history about scoundrels and scandals and people acting badly. I mean, we'd have no drama, I guess, if we didn't have scoundrels and villains. I mean, why at this moment in time is it important for us to look at ourselves as critically as you have done in this book, and I think importantly, and wonder about the moral center of our lives and whether it's been hollowed out?
I think it's this sense, and this may just be my sense, but it's that sense that people are not deliberately engaging in bad behavior. They're somehow so lost their moral compass that they just compulsively or impulsively do things that are scurrilous. And it's almost as if it never occurs to them that this is scurrilous behavior. It's a kind of moral blindness or something. So I thought maybe, and what I was looking for was just some very simple kind of slender moral code that could be slid into public discourse without asking people to undergo entire religious conversions to embrace. So that was my idea, was, look, what is there some way we could increase the chances that people will act well?
It's interesting. I wonder how much institutions and influencers have an impact on the way the rest of us behave. I mean, I've got to admit it. I'm going to say it out loud. I've said it on many podcasts. I mean, Donald Trump to me is the Terminator of a lack of shame. He just keeps coming at you with more harmful thoughts, lies, rants, and such. I mean, how much does that influence the rest of us to see the behavior that he has gotten away with, of the questionable moral compass that he has had? And of course, it's not only Donald Trump. We look at many priests and high members in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. We look at institutions like banking, and they seem to be rancid. I know you point to Wells Fargo in your book, but we could look at many other institutions that we have venerated in our society and bailed out, in fact.
Some of the answer to this question, I think, has to come from our adoration of celebrity culture. And you were asking, you know, where are we now in the larger scheme of things? And I don't know, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. We're both of us students of American trends. But it seemed to me, I don't know, maybe 18 months ago, that you could feel the beginnings of a kind of celebrity fatigue, where people who were now beginning to think that maybe celebrities in general were a bad idea. You know, the famous case in point was Madonna, who was asked to say the praises of Aretha Franklin and managed to mention herself like 70 times and Aretha Franklin twice. And there's just some sense that, oh, okay, really, we've gone too far. We've given these people too much license, too much adoration. But to the extent that you're exactly right, that we've lost some of the elites that used to act as navigational satellites for us. And they were sometimes members of some clergy or other. They were sometimes even social elites. I mean, you look at sort of magazines from America in the, even as late as the 50s, and Life would do admiring pictures of families in Philadelphia. And you'd think, what is the point of this article? I mean, these people are not interesting. They're just wealthy. And but that was the point of the article, that there was something intrinsically interesting about the life of old money Philadelphians, and they had a kind of moral influence. One to know how they were living in order to emulate that living. And of course, well, happily we snapped out of that sometime in the 60s. We came to our senses. But as you say, you know, elite after elite, for good or ill, they gave us some, they were exemplars of one kind or another, but almost all of them have fallen silent. Again, with the exception of celebrities who continue to mesmerize us for some purposes. But even here, I think people are going, wait a second, are these people, especially because some of them have created the appearance that there is a devil's bargain here that they couldn't resist, and their influence prompts us, that means that we have a difficult resisting. And that is, if you've got the choice of sacrificing your personal honor to get this thing, this magically powerful thing called celebrity, go for the celebrity, right? There's no cost too high for this magical thing called celebrity. And we see people embarrassing themselves, which is one kind of dishonorable behavior, but sometimes just doing horrifying, the Wells Fargo scandal being a case in which apparently the C-suite couldn't resist the treasure available to them when they conducted themselves in a manner that no bank would have ever considered conducting themselves in, and, you know, 100 years before.
But so, they are still in business. I remember their ad campaign trying to inoculate themselves from setting up these fake accounts for people. I mean, things that are truly unconscionable, particularly in a society where we think that we have enough, at least, basic regulation in place that can protect us from the horrors of people doing things so egregious that it can affect our own ability even to get a loan going forward and to really mess up our credit scores, which evidently we care a whole lot about, and yet they go on.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's one of the things I sort of contemplate in the book, is the possibility that we may have to rethink this idea that America is a place of second chances. I know when we confront our God, whomever that God is, probably second chances exist there. But when it comes to the social, you know, the public good, maybe it's the case that if you behave yourself with sufficient kind of disregard for goodness and decency, then you're kind of done. You're kind of out. I always think of Lance Armstrong as being a candidate for that notion of exclusion. You know, and I think even as we speak, he's planning his return to celebrity. But Surely not. I mean, surely this guy misbehaves so completely that we should, I wonder if we shouldn't make this an explicit kind of thing to say, look, you had honor. We endowed you with celebrity. You misbehaved yourself. You dishonored yourself in your sport, and now you're done. We're not sending you to prison, but we're certainly not letting you back into the charm circle called celebrity.
Well, it's interesting. I worked for PBS for many years, or a public television station in Connecticut, and you point a lot at Charlie Rose in your book. And then you do give a reference to Matt Lauer, of course. We could go to Roger Ailes. Bill O'Reilly, I want to point his case out, because they had to really cover up whatever he was doing with women on his staff. And now he's trying to sell me silver and tell me that I've got to get some kind of protection for my mortgage, and he's the arbiter of what it is that I need to do for myself, and I don't want to listen to him. I mean, I think I have a whole lot more honor than he has in the way I've conducted my life. Why would I ever listen to him? Why would anybody pay him to endorse their product?
Yeah, no, and that's somebody making a bargain of their own, aren't they? To participate in that piece of the celebrity culture is, I think, a deeply dubious exercise, especially if and when it means that you're leveraging somebody's powers of influence to persuade people to do things that are not in their best interest, like buy lots of silver, which may or may not be the right hedge against the financial chaos coming
our
way.
But Bill O'Reilly's not going to tell me that or convince me of that, I assure you.
So,
let me ask you, in the book, you have so many interesting examples of honor through the ages and such, but I want to get to the modern era and where we are today. And you said something that really struck me. You said honor can grow when we slow down and stay in places rather than, you know, trying to find too much mobility. Now, you and I are both Connecticut residents. And you pointed out that there were a lot of people isolating themselves in Fairfield County, where you live. And now they're looking at the town center. They're looking at gathering places, well, before the pandemic, where some type of connection to place, some kind of long historical sweep of really being there, and people really measuring you and your honor and your dignity and what you've done for the community as having a newfound importance rather than whether you've got a Porsche or a Maserati in your garage.
Yeah, I'm trying to argue that honor has two faces. One is inward looking, and the one we're talking about here is outward looking. And the idea here is that we participate in a reputation economy, as the economists would call it, where the things that we do for the common good are publicly registered, maybe not in an official way, but people around you in your community know you to have engaged in honorable behavior. I've got a neighbor living two doors down from me, and we fell into step. We went for had the habit of going for walks together, and slowly over the course of these many walks, it became clear that this guy was unbelievably active in my community, and I had no notion that he was that active, and I began to understand that nobody had a clear idea of how much he was doing, and I thought, wow, his name is Bob. I thought, we need more Bobs, and unless we're prepared to honor a guy like Bob and his accomplishments, not with slavish admiration, just with this kind of knowing respect for what he had done for our community, we can't expect, I mean, some people are just endowed with this natural generosity, and they just do things for their neighbors, and they don't care that they're not acknowledged. But imagine creating many more of those people by giving even small amounts of acknowledgement, I think would encourage this reputation economy. So that was the idea there.
Interesting that CNN does a show every year with an award ceremony for heroes. At the same time, one of the most popular programs on Showtime is called Shameless, where they show some really bad behavior. And so I've got to ask you, who's winning in this battle for honor? And perhaps this is also a good time for us to talk about what honor really is.
Who's winning? I don't know. I think we're all losing this one, aren't we, to the extent that honor is hard for some people, not just to do, but to imagine. That's when you know you're in trouble. I had studied Elizabethan England for some while, and so I had this sense of a society in which honor worked to produce better behavior and then sometimes glorious accomplishments. And I thought, wow, you know, this had been a moral compass for you know, thousands of years and millions of people. Maybe there's something left in it for us. And I thought, you know, could you re-engineer it and take out the bad? And God knows there was lots of things bad about honor in the Elizabethan period, and take what was good and see if that wasn't a chance to make, to encourage just all, it's almost a statistical exercise, right? Could you create a moral atmosphere in which bad behavior is less likely? If that's all you do, you know, and in these circumstances this grim, I'll take small victories. If that's all you do, then that's something. So yeah, that was my hope. That, sorry, you had asked, are we winning? And I think the answer is no. And what was the other question?
Well, what is honor? I mean, as you define it, as we should at least try to find our way to it, what is honor?
I think it is these two things, at least as I'm defining it for contemporary purposes. One is it looks like and acts like something like a self-esteem or self-respect, but it comes not from the psychological foundations that we typically think of when we think about self-esteem. It comes from our recognition that we have committed ourselves to things that we think are important, whatever those things are, and that honor, that sense of self-esteem, armors us against the disapproval of larger communities if they don't like what we've done or who we are, right? So I think we need to make a place for a species of honor that really secures people in the face of public disapproval, because some of the most potent acts of honor come from people who are not widely respected or anti-celebrities of a kind, but who I don't know if you saw the Madame Curie documentary.
On Amazon.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That was a great kind of treatment of what it meant for this woman to be unshakable in her conviction that she was doing the right thing, scorned by the larger society, scorned by male scientists. She just stayed true to her course and, in you know, changed medical history in the process. So that's an example of that kind of internal honor, where you set your own course, you stay to your own course, and honor sustains you as you achieve that objective, even in the face of public disapproval. So that's inward focusing. Honor. The outward is this reputational economy thing, where you do good things, you're acknowledged to do good things, you're approved of in the things you do, as a result of which your public reputation rises. Not because you're charismatic or because you're beautiful or you're good at acting, but because you helped build a Little League diamond in a neighborhood that otherwise would not have one. It's that kind of thing, I think, that shows two faces, I think.
Grant McCracken is with us, the new Honor Code, a simple plan for raising our standards and restoring our good names. We'll get to some of the ideas that you have in that regard, though none of this seems simple to me, because it sounds to me like what you're really assailing are many of the things that Americans really look to. They look to celebrity. They look to those who maybe have more and they wish they did, though we need policies to make sure that more people have what is necessary to sustain them, but we don't need excess wealth. And I have a very simple maxim. I know you're a very learned anthropologist, and I love anthropology when I studied it in college, but my simple maxim is nothing in America succeeds like excess. Am I wrong?
I hope so. I mean, I hope that, you know, we love the spectacular, and Americans love moments when scale is, you know, where somebody is so accomplished or so embarrassing or so over the top somehow that we're thrilled to see this public performance, because it violates our expectations and it's horrifying and wonderful all at once. Or as is the present culture now, now it's wonderful, right? It's no longer horrifying. Anything spectacularly good or bad is good. So I think, yeah, we could, you know, we used to think about actors as slightly dubious people. You know, Victorians thought about actors as being slightly dubious because, well, why? Well, they lied for a living, right? They got on the stage and pretended to be somebody else. And they did it so effectively that they persuaded us they were somebody else. They took us in. They were con people, con men and con women. And it's only in the last 150 years that we've come to heap praise upon these people. It seems to me it makes sense to go back and think, ugh, you know, that's charming as it goes. But you're just an actor. And even in your best moments, you're really lying. And we're thrilled by the lie. But we don't wish to credit you now as a moral exemplar.
What about those public servants? I know in other societies, I have read in Europe, Dr. Fauci would be knighted. He would be somebody that the entire society would venerate. And yet in America, many public servants, maybe call them the deep state, but who work basically tirelessly their entire lives for the public good. And we denigrate them often. We say that they're lazy or they don't have the motivation to go out in the private sector, whatever it may be. And you say that generally we are ceasing to believe in our collective decency. What do we need to restore that?
You know, to sustain those people who serve us bravely without acknowledgement, I think it is, you know, it doesn't have to be honor, but we have to encourage a culture that gives them the right and the materials to reward themselves, to approve of themselves, to accept themselves as exemplary figures, even if the rest of us, as you say, are not prepared to give them that their due. So, yeah, I think that's something you build into curricula and you encourage people to take seriously. And that's a kind of question of quiet dignity. I think you see it play. I mean, that's sort of the interesting thing to do as you do the anthropology of contemporary culture and you think about an innovation like this. How would you create an honor code? And they're always looking around for materials there on the ground that you could use. And one of these is that sense of quiet dignity, where you'll see somebody going about a job that doesn't, you know, pay them in salary and it doesn't pay them in celebrity, but they do it and they do it well and they do it with dignity. And I think for some of us, some of the times look at them and go, you know, good on you. Good. We acknowledge that quiet dignity with a quiet, quite literally unspoken kind of acknowledgement. We see somebody doing that and we think, you know, I see it all the time, right? Somebody who's doing that difficult job with dignity and I can feel myself responding to that. So I know it's there in the culture somewhere. You know, it's not in me just because I made it up. It's there in me because it's somewhere in the culture. So I think to encourage that would help us honor people who are now not being honored.
Now, is that a function of the news media paying some attention to these small acts of kindness and goodness? And they are replete throughout our society. I mean, I used to do a radio show, and there were so many people in the community that was pretty hard hit by deindustrialization, but people who were trying to clean up polluted rivers, people trying to restore old parks that were built by the Olmsted in the past and were just such beautiful representations of a public space. Yeah. And there were lots of articles in newspapers, and I would bring those people on the air and let's shine a light on them. They weren't looking Mr. Kraken, to put that light on themselves. They were just doing it because it was the right thing to do. And we know in our own society that people are doing the right things every minute of every waking hour. We see all those acts. It may be somebody coming to our house at 3 in the morning because we had an alarm go off and they're a volunteer firefighter. They're not getting paid for this at all. Talk about a selfless group. And we have many of them in our state of Connecticut. So what separates them, or how do we emulate them more than we do those who have this outsized attainment for things that aren't really that relevant or important to the day-to-day lives that we live?
I think we're on the verge of it, to the extent that we're now rethinking privilege and we're rethinking elites, right? We're saying, you know, we have to be clear that some people have advantages they have not earned, and we're rethinking about what an entire American culture looks like if you get rid of those inequities and inequalities. And once you do that, you're now in a position to say, well, how do we apportion? How do we serve out recognition now that we've stopped taking for granted that somebody who's a university professor is obviously more somehow grander or more dignified than somebody who is not? Not that anybody is very quick to lionize university professors for pretty obvious reasons. So we're on the verge of doing that, right, of rethinking privilege and elitism. But we need to take the next step, which is, okay, how do we say, and I think perhaps what you said is exactly right. Are people doing things that are thankless? The simple act of acknowledgement begins to correct that. So it's thankful, not completely, but a little better than thankless.
I want to go into just a couple of your examples quickly. In chapter one, Symptoms of Honor Shortage, and you refer us back to the Harvard soccer scandal of 2016. Can you summarize that and tell us what lesson we should take from that?
Someone discovered, and it may have been the Crimson newspaper, that in fact the male team of Harvard soccer players was keeping a spreadsheet that evaluated the women on the women's soccer team at Harvard. And they were describing them in terms of sexual, they were assigning sexual positions. They were engaged in behavior so horrifyingly sexist and demeaning and diminishing and vicious that you could barely, believe your eyes. What was stunning was this scandal, once it got out, ran through the campus, the college, the university, like a virus. I mean, nobody didn't know what these guys had done. But what was strange was that when the university, various parts of the university were asked to address the issue as a moral lesson, as an opportunity to engage in the stuff of education, which is to signal to kids what they should care about, things they should do, things they shouldn't do, almost everybody whiffed. It was astounding. The president, the dean of the college, the school newspaper, and this must have broken the hearts of young journalists there. The school newspaper said to the soccer team, the male soccer team, we will accept a letter of apology from you. And the guys on the team said, but we're not going to sign it. Surely somebody there, the Crimson, must have said, probably at the top of their voices, it's not an apology if you don't sign it. Anonymous apologies can't be apologies. But the newspaper let this letter of apology stand without signatures. So I thought, wow, that's just, I mean, over and over again, Harvard, what's the metaphor I'm looking at when you try to kick a ball and you miss the ball? I'm trying to work in the soccer theme. But they whiffed over and over and over again, as a result of which this behavior didn't get condemned. Here's the strange thing. I went back to their Twitter feed to see if they had fought out the issue on social media. And in point of fact, the Twitter feed goes absolutely dark for, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. And then they start talking about the awards they've handed out to various members of the male team, including an award to some guy who was seen to be a credit to the team, the sport and the university. And I thought, are you kidding me? Are you actually kidding me that you can praise this kid? And, you know, he's, I'm sure he's not, it's person, you know, this is a shared responsibility, but the fact that praise, there was any praise left over here, just seemed to me astounding. So you can hear the indignation is still upon me.
No, I can.
But anyhow,
so the reward structure in our society, when you talk about the swift self, defines itself by rushing into the world away from connections and obligations that define an individual in a traditional society. So we like the person who's always busy, who doesn't take time to reflect. They're always right. on the go, and they really yeah. pride themselves that I'm more active than you. What did you do today? What did you get done in the immediate sense? We also reward the person who accumulates the most toys, generally, in our society. Yeah. And we really venerate people who have figured out a way perhaps to make it using certain stealth and guile in the process. So we have a reward structure that seems to be all wrong. And then, of course, as you say, when we find those people going off the rails, which shouldn't surprise us, given the reward structure, there's no shame at all.
There are no recantations. There are no nobody throws themselves no one's looking for our absolution. No apologies are forthcoming. Yes, that is, that Swiss self thing is a really interesting kind of idea. It's just this notion that lives work best when conducted at speed, that you want to keep going flat out constantly. And I think it was just, you know, we think about the Mad Men era where people appeared to smoke and drink as much as possible, and just, you know, rocket through their personal and their public lives. That's a recipe for moral confusion or failing, right? Where you just don't notice how badly you're behaving because you're not reflecting on anything. You're just pelting from one moment to the next moment, from one appetite to the next appetite, from one accomplishment to the next accomplishment. That's not the stuff of Aristotelian contemplation, right?
By the way, in your book, let me go to page 153. And folks, this is a very easy to read book. It really is, but there's a lot in it that you really need to take to heart. You say we could shame drug dealers, but we don't. We could shame corrupt civic employees, but we don't do that either. We should really shame telemarketers. In my opinion, Guantanamo is too good for telemarketers. It's as if shame is too obvious, too biblical, too much like Shakespeare as they played it in the 19th century, all blood and thunder. We like to think we are subtler, more forgiving now. Shame is a public hanging in a time when we prefer a stinging dose of rebuke. But what if shame is actually a good thing? Make shame a good thing for us. Help us to understand that concept.
So we're a member of some organization in New York City. We're contemplating, or maybe not even contemplating, on the verge now of inflicting sexual abuse on a subordinate, on an intern. And we don't hesitate. We don't pause unless and until, as a culture, we create a kind of shadow of doubt. That's all I'm, you know, in the perfect world, somebody would come to their senses morally and go, no, this is wrong, I mustn't do it, but that's not happening. So what we want is a shadow of a doubt. And I think that shadow of a doubt comes from the possibility that shame is an active beast in our midst. Someone has to fear the beast of shame, some people do, in order to prevent themselves from acting abusively. So that's what I'm saying, you know, shame is not a good or noble thing, but it may be an effective way of getting some people to do the right thing. And I think you know, the 20th century was a therapeutic culture. It was a time we thought long and hard about how we should conduct ourselves, manage our emotional lives, think about our psychic condition. And as a result of that, we came to the conclusion, I think, that shame was a bad and dangerous thing. Yes, of course, it was used by the public sphere to discourage kinds of behaviors, but it inflicted so much harm on the individual that it didn't rehabilitate them. And worse than that, it inflicted harm on the public domain and was therefore bad for us all. So the notion was shame is beneath us, or shame is just wrong. Shame is, you know, the punishment is worse than the crime in the case of shame. But maybe it's the case.
But do we leave that to the society? Because we've done a lot with law and order over the years, and now we're looking at some of the punitive actions that we've taken for bad behavior, and we say, well, maybe we really need to rethink the best way to restore somebody to society, and we say, let's give people a second chance. So how does that reconcile itself to the notion that either the society or individuals within the community should look at this person and say, not in our midst. This isn't behavior that is honorable to us if you want to live among us, even if the society has said you can come back in.
You know, maybe the society shouldn't, maybe all of us as individuals ought to, as part of a collective sphere, say, you know, we're withdrawing from that idea. We no longer as a collectivity believe that in fact it's okay to behave in a shameful manner, behave shamefully, and that defines you privately, we hope, but maybe not, but publicly certainly, right? You will always be, Lance Armstrong will always be known as the person who corrupted himself in his sport. You can't escape that. So I think that's, it's ugly, but hey, we're ugly. You know, you think about the amount of crime being committed in the name of self-exploration and, you know, finding the real me and looking for our internal bliss. And you know, I respect that. I think the glory of individualism is one of the things that makes us interesting. But when it becomes a license to behave badly, I don't know that that can be right.
Why is it that I worry a whole lot about legacy? I think about it a lot. I mean, what am I leaving behind? I have a grandchild on the way. How are they going to remember, you know, this particular grandparent? And that means something to me. But that must have been instilled by my parents, who were very honorable people, who never wanted to hurt other people. Why is that perhaps not something that impacts everyone? They don't think beyond that to their long-standing legacy and the way the third generation is going to be talking about them if they are talked about at all.
Personally, and I may sound like I contradict myself here, but I kind of like the idea that every individual is, to use the language you used to hear in Boston, every tub its own bottom, this notion that everybody is freestanding. And that meant, among other things, that we don't judge you by what your ancestors accomplished, and that what you do in this life won't act as an equity or a capital on which your descendants can draw. Because that's part of an honor culture that went badly wrong. Because the notion was, when you behave badly, you damage the honor that had been created for you by your ancestors that would descend through you to the people to come in your in your family, and that was the reason that that was your real punishment, certainly that it was a punishment was a good thing. That somebody coming up, the next generation, was now flawed for the fact that you had behaved badly, seems to me unfair, right? That seems to me where shamefulness we should dole shamefulness out in. By generations, not across generations. Because, right,
it's interesting watching The Crown and seeing the way Prince was, the way the prince was being treated when he had a conflict about his own romantic link to a woman who was married, and thinking that was passed down from a grandfather. Very interesting. The new honor code that you talk about at the end of the book. And you give us, I believe it is 10 ways to look at the new honor code that we should try to reestablish in America. What's most important to take away from the new honor code that you end your book with?
There are simple, I guess the chief one is roles and rules, right? And here again, for the anthropologist, there's residual morality in our world, and those rules come defined by rules. So we have this notion, and sometimes these are slightly old-fashioned, but hey, but that a parent should behave these ways towards their children and toward their parents, right? And that's all we need for most honorable behavior is for the individual. Again, I'm trying to almost mechanize this, right? You, the individual, identify your roles. Once you have your roles, you have some rules. Follow those rules. And that spares me having to say what the rules are of morality are, because nobody wants to hear somebody, you know, nobody wants a Tony Robbins recitation of what the world must be for every individual. I was trying to come up with a code here that would work for a maximum number of individuals without the interference of the anthropologist saying, here's who you must be. If everyone just hews to the rules of their roles, we've done something. We've brought people closer to the idea of honor.
But you don't think we're near that at this moment in time as a society, that we've gone a bit off the rails?
I think we have. I think people disappoint their spouses, they disappoint their kids, they disappoint their parents. And I say it's as if people have just lost touch with the simple rules that would have given them clarity and given them the opportunity to do what we hope people will do.
By the way, there's a very interesting section that I'll let you read in the book about boomers and millennials, and we've done a lot of reporting on this podcast about these generations, and you've got a very interesting take on millennials living under the deep cover of their boomer parents. Well, I'm a boomer parent who can't believe that what our life you know, goals and aspirations and values are not as easily understood by our kids, that, we thought that was just something that would be passed down. Well, Grant McCracken, right. The book is called The New Honor Code, A Simple Plan for Raising Our Standards and Restoring Our Good Names. And it's not that simple, really. And you're going to have to really pour through this book and really give us some thought yourself. I think it's a really important topic. And that's why we brought Mr. McCracken to you today. Thank you so much for being with us on America Trends.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for brilliant questions.